This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. There are 4 days to go until Election Day, and the gloves are off in local races.
You are putting loyalty to the Republican Party above your commitment to these values.
Governor Baker,
and 15th. I think it matters.
I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I don't plan to vote for him if he runs for re-election. Most people know where I'm coming from with respect to the president.
I've already said that I will take a look at running for president after the election, but I guarantee this, no matter what I do, I will work for the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Ironically, my opponent and President Trump do have something in common. Neither wants to be senator from Massachusetts, but both want to be president.
I'm also aware of your exaggerations when you claim that you apprehended the shoe bomber. Completely untrue.
I never said I apprehended the shoe bomber in my life.
The fact of the matter is you've been portraying yourself as this person who apprehended the shoe bomber. You collared the shoe bomber. You collared. That's the word.
I defy you to find one time a quote where I've said
it.
You're a liar.
And you're a faker.
Okay.
A feisty montage there of the final debates in the gubernatorial race between Governor Charlie Baker and Jay Gonzalez, the U.S. Senate race between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Deal, and the ruckus Secretary of State's race between incumbent Bill Galvin and challenger Anthony Amore. There's also the three ballot questions, some congressional races, so a lot to dig into with our Week in Review panel. And with me this week is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, thanks for being on Radio Boston.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, welcome back to Radio
Boston.
Good
to be with you.
So let's start with that race for governor. Of course, WBUR was one of the co-hosts last night of the final debate in that race. What were your big takeaways from that final clash? Marie, let's start with you.
Well, I think that based upon my read of it, Gonzalez came out of the gate ready to take the governor directly on and to distinguish himself by establishing that he is the candidate who is ready to take bold action and bold steps and to really try to pin the governor's record and actions to that of the gentleman sitting in the corner office in D.C.
And Jim, what stood out to you?
So, you know, I think a little trip back in history is helpful here. If you go back to 1994, an election very much like this one. In 1992, you had Patrick Buchanan running nativist kind of movement. That's sort of the backdrop. That's the music. That's the backdrop for this election here in Massachusetts. And I think that the polls suggest that it will be a similarly large margin for Charlie Baker. Now, in the debate, what I would say is interesting is that that Jay Gonzalez appealed to the Democratic purists, and I think he did an admirable job of that. But I think one of the things that people have to keep in mind is in 1994, about 45% of the electorate was unenrolled. About 40% were Democrats, and another 13% were Republicans. We have changed a lot. We've added about 1.3 million voters to our registered voters. But the percentage of folks who are actually Democrats is down to 30%, 33%, and Republicans are 10%. We are truly an unenrolled independent electorate. And I think that Baker is making a beeline for the unenrolled independent voters in Massachusetts.
So you mentioned the polling. Let me just fill in some detail on what we're looking at here. A new WBUR poll this week found that among likely voters, Baker is still highly popular. He's at 62%. Gonzalez at just 25%. I think notably there, even if you added all of the undecideds and assumed they all swung for Gonzalez, it still wouldn't be enough. He's going to have to peel off some Baker supporters. So Marie, does he have a shot?
I think I've previously said on this program that I think this was always this is Charlie Baker's to lose and Charlie Baker's to win. While I agree that the state is heavily unenrolled, but it usually breaks Democratic.
Absolutely.
But Charlie Baker has shown himself a deft, participatory, bipartisan sort of leader. And I think that he has attracted a significant number of Democrats to his side. And to his credit, he's been able to get them to step out away from the Democratic Party to break this whole hole that we have in terms of very partisan approach towards our electoral process, where he's had Democrats come out and strongly support him. So I don't see the Democrats taking over the corner house office. I do think that Jay Gonzalez was very important that he continues to push and to highlight some of the very issues that we need to have highlighted in the state. Yes, transportation is one of them. The continued way to challenge how human services is delivered, and particularly for me, the early education and care conversation, which is if we get it done right, then we won't have to pay for remedial. I think that conversation, highlighting that conversation, is all very positive, and we'll see if it makes any difference on Tuesday.
So let's hear a bit from the candidates from last night. So last night's debate was co-sponsored by WBUR, WCVB, the Boston Globe, and UMass Boston. And the candidates were asked, among other things, what the big idea would be that would define each of their governorships. Charlie Baker said that combating effects of climate change would be sort of his signature issue. Gonzalez kind of double-dipped. He said early free child education, and he also pointed to single-payer health care. And that prompted this response from Governor Baker.
It's dishonest to stand here in front of the voters, say you're going to be bold, and then talk about initiatives that cost billions of dollars that you don't have the dollars to pay for. What I've talked about in very specific detail are things we've either already done or things we're planning to do that are already programmed and budgeted.
Gonzalez, of course, was ready with a comeback.
Going to single-payer health care will save us money if we do it thoughtfully. And yes, it is being bold. And I have a specific plan to raise the money we need to do the things that I want to do that will cost more money.
So, Jim, we've talked with Jay Gonzalez about this on Radio Boston. His plan is to tax big college endowments. Some political observers believe that that's a proposal that would be dead on arrival on Beacon Hill. So what do you make of the governor's charge that he's sort of spending the same money over and over again and can't actually pay for all the things he's promising?
Look, whatever your view is on single payer, I think the experience around the country is that it will not save money. Vermont tried this and it failed spectacularly. Not to say that the impulse behind it's a bad one, but especially when we have a system that is currently insuring 97% of our residents, it's probably a non-starter. On the question of taxing endowments, it's got a couple of big roadblocks. One is that the SJC, the Supreme Judicial Court of the state of Massachusetts, just ruled on what was called the Fair Share Amendment. And in their decision, there is language in there that would make that a pretty tough climb. The second thing I'd say is the state constitution, since the time that John Adams wrote it, has a clause in it that says that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will cherish education mm-hmm. and the university in Cambridge. And they're pointing to Harvard University. Now, if you want to tax your endowment, I have a feeling that's not called cherishing. So I think it runs into a couple of pretty big Constitution, not only political roadblocks.
Certainly Harvard doesn't feel very cherished in that way. Go ahead, Marie.
Yeah, I'm sure Harvard doesn't feel cherished, and I'm not certain that was the intent was to protect Harvard necessarily in terms of why that language cherish was put in there. I think it spoke to the fact that we really believe that an educated electorate is critical to our democracy and that we must invest in that for it to happen. I think both candidates have to face to the fact that for all the things that we're talking about, you're going to have to find more resources to accomplish. You can't take care of education the way that we need to and not find the resources to do it. I think it's disingenuous on both parts to suggest that you're not going to. But nobody wants to deal with that reality. You can't fix DCF in the way that it actually needs to be fixed in a real way to make certain the kids who are most vulnerable are cared for without figuring out the resources to do that. Earlier education and care, we've never really considered it as part of the reality is the federal government has been paying for that in this state. It has not been paid by out of the tax dollars in the general fund. And so if we're serious about it, then we need to really be talking about it. And everybody should be talking about how we build a system that is comprehensive, that looks at all children and figure out the best way to make it affordable for everybody. Because it's not simply low-income families that it's a challenge for. It's a challenge for many middle to low and working people who need their children in safe, nurturing places and whose children need to be able to get the support they need at the very beginning. And so for all of us and for this economy to thrive, we need to figure that out. Nobody's talking about how they're going to pay for it. We're going to keep pretending that we can spend the same dollars that we have, and we know that that's not plausible.
All right. So some of these same themes did come up in another debate this week. This was in the U.S. Senate debate on WBZ between Senator Elizabeth Warren and her Republican challenger, Jeff Deal. And they both sort of took a national focus. You had Elizabeth Warren talking about Deal's promise to have Donald Trump's back in Washington.
He's also embraced a tax plan that his Republican colleagues say they're going to pay for by cutting Social Security. And Mr. Deal says he wants to be with Donald Trump 100% of the time.
And then this was Jeff Deal's response.
Elizabeth Warren desperately wants you to believe that her focus is on Massachusetts. But the fact is, she doesn't care about your house. She cares about the White House.
All right, good line there, Jim. But is it working? What's your read of this race?
Well, I think anybody who's running in Massachusetts knows as a baseline that this is not news to anyone that Donald Trump is not popular here. So if you want to win the election, what you're going to do is you're going to nationalize the election. And if you're trying to win the election, you're trying to make it state and local. The problem for, I think, for Deal, and I would say one thing about Deal, is that if you read about him, you'd say he had horns and he was a terrible person and all that. If you watched, I think some of the horns may have come off, but there's no way he can climb out of that, the deficit that he has, because he is much aligned with Trump, and Trump is just not popular here.
Is that the winning strategy, though, for Elizabeth Warren, too, to sort of try to tie him to Donald Trump and say that he's basically just going to be a rubber stamp?
I mean, I don't think that she hurts herself by connecting him to Trump directly, particularly as it activates the Democratic base and a significant percentage of the unenrolled that are here in Massachusetts who do not necessarily align themselves with Trump. I do say that there is a population in the state of Massachusetts that Deal is speaking to as it relates to Trump, and it probably more out of the 495 area that embraces some of the sentiments. And so he's got his own base, I think, just like Trump does, that he's trying to mobilize. And the question is who's going to get their base out. So I don't think it hurts either of them, and with their established constituencies, to be able to continue to move the conversation this way.
I do want to touch on at least one of the ballot questions that's also on the ballot on Tuesday, and that first question is about nurse staffing ratios. Question one would set mandatory minimums for nurse-to-patient ratios, and it is the most competitive of the three. A Boston Globe Suffolk University poll early this week found that 58% of likely voters are now against that ballot question. We saw the same 27-point margin in a WBUR poll this week. And Jim, just to sort of remind people of the history, that's a big swing because in September, we had a Globe poll that showed the yes side up by 19. A short time after that, BUR had the race tied. What do you suppose has changed?
What's changed is I think there's been a lot of money spent on the No on One campaign, and that they were able to line up all kinds of nurses and professionals who understood that it could be a real have a negative impact on community hospitals. It could have a negative impact on the cost of health care. And frankly, I mean, I find Paul Levy in Commonwealth Magazine made a very good argument to me. He was saying, look, it's a little bit like setting up a quota on a third baseman or a quota on how many tight ends you want to have on a team. And the fact is, in a team, you know, it's composed of a whole bunch of people. And it's not just nurses. It's doctors. It's nurses. It's radiologists. It's technicians. It's housekeepers. And you have to actually take all of those assets and make sure that you're supporting the patient as much as possible. So if you just say we're going to make sure we focus on nurses, you're actually dissipating your ability to actually have all the whole team there. So he's talking about safety and quality of care is actually potentially suffering as a result of it.
And Marie, I heard from voters as we were reporting on this issue who sort of felt ill-equipped to make the decision. Mm-hmm. They felt like they really wanted to find out what nurses had to say about this. And we polled the nurses. They were pretty evenly split.
That's
so even
right.
Even they seemed to not exactly know how to feel about it.
I think it's as you've indicated, it's a controversial conversation even within the profession. And honestly, I agree with the opinion that we shouldn't be legislating something that should be intimately determined with the people who are closest to it. And then ballot petition sounds great. As a former legislator, they make me a little uncomfortable because we've not had the kind of debate. We've not had the kind of real deliberative process that is necessary for us to come out with an agreement that both sides will feel uncomfortable about. And here's the other concern that I have. When we define nursing care, all right, there's a hierarchy, and now nobody's talking about that hierarchy within nursing care. And I'm a kid whose mother worked as a nurse's aide for many years. I know plenty of folks who they had CNAs, certified nurse's assistants. You had licensed practical nurse, and you have the nurse. who are we talking about in this lineup when you're going to limit the number of patients that a registered nurse, I presume is who we're talking about, is assigned? What happens downstream in terms of who's responsible for that patient? I think there needs to be a more holistic conversation about what nursing care is and the breakdown of responsibilities and how we're really going to support everyone and within the context of nursing care in order to make it more palatable to the entire profession. And so I have some real concerns about the representation of nursing care and what that means, because the ones who give the baths are often the licensed practical nurse or the register or the CNA or the nurse's assistant. And oftentimes the folks who act, and I've read some of the things that nurses are doing. I'm not suggesting they don't, and they possibly do, but we have to respect the talent and the labor of others who are part of that as well.
All right. So the nurse ballot question and all the other races will be decided on Tuesday. Tuesday, folks, get out and vote. I do want to turn now to the mass shooting from this past weekend at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The funerals continued this week for those victims. Hundreds of people came out to show their support.
Ozi Vezimrad Yahvayahi.
Tonight at Temple Israel of Boston, Governor Baker and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh will attend a Shabbat of comfort, community, and courage. Here's Temple Israel Rabbi Matthew Soffer.
Love, we know, is stronger than hate, and those who will pray with us are those who believe that we're not here to fuel the fire of hate, but to kindle the light of love.
Rabbi Soffer there talking about the fire of hate and the fire of love. And the Anti-Defamation League, we should note, has documented a 57% rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. since 2017. That includes bomb threats, assaults, vandalism. And Marie, one of the things that stands out to me this week is that in the wake of the shooting in Pittsburgh, a lot of the conversation has been focused on that subject, on anti-Semitism, not so much on gun control as after other mass shootings. What do you make of that?
You know, I think the narrative is shifting because folks have not been able to really figure out how to get a hold. I mean, we've had Sandy Hook. We've had all of, and we went after, gun control. And for some reason, that has never bubbled up. We do not have the courage, the legislative courage, to make a decision on gun control. And it's as if the right to hold, to own a gun seems to have precedent over the right to life. And that to me is part of the challenge here. I do want to say it's just my condolences really to the victims, first of all, in Pittsburgh. But at the same time, I also take a look at what happened that same week is you had another gentleman who tried to get into a church and could not get in there. And when he could not, a black church.
That's
He could not get into that black church, went out and shot two black people just because that was what he found available. And then essentially said to, when he was challenged on it by another individual who was Caucasian, he was told, "We don't shoot each other." So the message there was, we're going after some very specific targeted people. And it is the environment that's been created from the top, I think, in this country is sending a really bad message. And people who may have had some issues now are finding the courage to act on them, where those folks have always existed, I think, but they have not been empowered. And they've definitely been empowered. And we're seeing the carnage that is the result of that.
And Jim, of course, the other notable episode of violence this week had a far less sympathetic victim, to say the least. That was, of course, the death of the notorious mobster James Whitey Bulger, who was assassinated this week in a West Virginia prison. And we heard earlier this week from our own David Boweri on how, even in death, Bulger somehow managed to get the upper hand in a way.
Bulger was brilliant at this in an evil genius sort of way. He was able to spotlight corruption, incompetence, the posturing, the hypocrisy of government. And here, once again, he's putting attention on the Department of Justice. They didn't do their job.
So, Jim, how did you respond to the news? I mean, I think a lot of people had mixed feelings. It's hard to really feel sorry to see this guy go, and yet the details of his demise were pretty grim. And as David Boweri just pointed out there, the Bureau of Prisons had one job, keep this guy alive, and they didn't manage to do it.
No, I agree. I mean, look at the horrifying crimes he committed. I think people forget that he was number two on the FBI's most wanted list after Osama bin Laden for a long time, right? So there's a lot in his past that is horrifying. While some families, I think, feel some level of satisfaction, I think we should be, I'm not trying to be soft on Bulger, we should be really concerned about this. While his crimes were heinous, these acts were either predictable or allowed by law enforcement. And, you know, it's, I know the FBI is coming under criticism from on top in the country and much unjustifiable. But this is actually really troubling. This kind of justice, just jailhouse justice, should not be allowed.
You know, we heard earlier this week, too, from relatives of some of the victims here who we should not overlook. And we spoke with Steve Davis. He's the brother of Deborah Davis. She was Stephen the Rifleman Fleming's girlfriend. She was killed in 1981 at just 26 years old. Whitey Bulger was charged with that crime, but not convicted of strangling and killing Deborah. Here's what Steve Davis told us.
Would never get the justice we deserve for my sister. The family has been torn apart over it. He's ruined a lot of people, and it's a wound that'll never heal. It's something that'll never heal or never go away.
Marie, can there be justice at this point? I mean, Whitey Bulger is dead. He can't be punished any further at this point. And the FBI has never fully accounted for its role in enabling his crimes. Are we sort of past the point of no return here, or is there still some hope for those families to get some closure?
For families who've been suffering with this trauma for so many years, I'm not certain what closure will look like for them, in all honesty, because who was it? One of the gentlemen talked about it being like a canker sore that you just can't get rid of. And I'm not certain if this dramatic action, because that's, you know, gets rid of that for them. And they lost their loved ones, are gone forever. What I'm concerned about, and I also say that there was a trial, that there was a finding of guilt, and he was imprisoned. I mean, so we may not like what the final penalty was, but there was. The system actually worked in that they spent the time, they investigated, they located, they tracked him down, they tried him, and he was put away. I think this the idea of taking a look at our criminal justice system, though, in its entirety, this is just another end of that spectrum. We've talked about it as it relates to the police. We have to look at it as it relates to the way the legislative process works in terms of the disparities some of our legislative actions create. We have to take a real look at it in terms of how justice gets executed within the courts themselves. And now we're looking in the prisons and we're saying, and he is just, I guess, the canary in the mine to get us to take a look at our system and really figure out who are we as a country? Who are we as a judicial system? And what are the expectations about how we're supposed to behave? And so Whitey Bulger notwithstanding, I think as a civil society, we need to take a look at as to whether or not this is the kind of justice, jailhouse justice, is what we want to support.
Certainly a lot to reflect on this week.
Marie
St. Fleur, the former Massachusetts state representative, now the principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you to you as well.
It's great to be with you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we'll look at the Harvard admissions trial, which wraps up today. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.